Cape Talk.
Health and wellness.
Now, almost exactly 2 years ago, we had a conversation about a topic that nobody really wants to talk about, how to support and care for terminally ill children. As I said earlier in the show, it's the kind of interview no parent wants to hear because nobody wants to let your mind even go there to think about the possibility of what it would be like to be in that position. But of course, the fact remains that many parents do face that reality. And if it was our lot to face that battle, we'd like to think that there would be somewhere there to help and someone to turn to for support. And at the time I introduced you to someone who is fighting very hard to make that kind of support more widely available. Dr. Michelle Mehring is a pediatrician specializing in palliative care for children. And 2 years ago, we told you about her organization, PEDS PAL, which had this grand vision of one day seeing a dedicated hospice for children right here in Cape Town. And 2 years later, she is a whole lot closer to seeing that dream realized because next Thursday, the 24th of May, she's going to figuratively cut the ribbon on the beginnings of that facility. And it's thanks in a large part to the legacy of a young man named Rowan Bloom, whose father Rod is with us today to share the story, as well as Michelle. It's lovely to have both of you with us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Pippa.
Michelle, at the time we spoke in 2016, I think PEDS PAL was really in its infancy and you were still offering outpatient-based clinics. You were traveling from hospital to hospital. Won't you just recap for us what is meant by palliative care and why it's such a tricky field, particularly when it comes to children?
Thanks, Pippa. It's really great to be back, and I can't believe it's been 2 years already. Yeah, so for the past 2 years, we've basically continued to be going from hospital to hospital, doing what we can, supporting dying children in hospital. And we actually opened an outpatient clinic 2 years ago where we can actually have really good consultations and conversations with families in the outpatient setting. But the gap continues to remain in that we don't have any dedicated space outside of hospitals and outside of children's own homes where we can actually support dying with a proper, properly trained staff in an environment that is conducive for that.
And with the dignity that you would hope for and the special care not only for the patients you're talking about, but of course for their families as well.
Exactly, the dignity and also the privacy. You know, hospitals also unfortunately have to have certain restrictions because they've got a lot of work to get done. And we can't have siblings and we can't have a whole lot of family members in and out there all the time. So, and also it's at the end of the day, it's still a hospital, and kids don't like hospitals naturally, you know. So to be able to provide them care in a really scary time of their lives in a really comfortable, homely facility is the dream that we're kind of working towards.
Of course, many of our listeners will be very familiar with the amazing work done by hospice and organizations like St. Luke's for adults. Does that care have to be specifically adapted for children in terms of the kind of equipment that is needed?
Definitely. I mean, adult hospices have been around in South Africa since the 70s. And we did have a trickling of children's hospices when we had the HIV epidemic. And we had a lot of AIDS babies dying. And then there were organizations providing this kind of care. But since getting on top of HIV, a lot of these organizations have since closed and the gap continues. And caring for dying children is very different from caring for adults. It's almost like having two patients because not only have you got the child, you've also got the carer, the parents, you've got the siblings. It's a lot more intense from an emotional perspective. Also, very young children can't say what they're feeling. They can't report their pain. So you have to be really specifically trained to pick up on those kind of things. And the drug management is complicated as well. People are scared of giving morphine to small babies. And there's a lot of fear around, giving the dose that's, you're uncomfortable with doing, and not everybody is used to having difficult conversations with children and also with their carers. So you do need to have specifically pediatric palliative care trained team to do this.
It really is a multidisciplinary team as well. You've reeled off a couple of examples there, for example, the drug management, everyone from the doctors to the counselors. I know your vision was to include a whole lot of, if I can call them, support services, everything from OT and aromatherapy, things that would help the patient feel better emotionally as well as physically.
So the nature or the practice of palliative care is that it's really holistic care. We're not just looking after the body. We're also looking after the mind, and we're also looking after the spirit, and we're supporting the family. Mm. And doctors don't have the skills to address all of those domains. So this is a team effort. It's doctors, it's nurses, it's counselors, it's social workers, and we also have integrative therapists. So we have massage, aromatherapy, music, art therapy, and especially for non-verbal children that don't even have the words to express how they are feeling. Mm. A lot of these indirect therapies are incredibly important to enable the child to tap into where he is and express that properly.
Okay. So it's wonderful to be able to talk to you, poised, as it were, to turn all of these big dreams into reality. And I'm going to ask you to pause for a second before we go down that road, because I'd really like to bring in our second guest today, Rod Bloom. As I mentioned at the start, the story of the children's hospice that is yet to come is very linked and tied up with the story of a young man named Rowan Bloom, who was Rod's son. And while we were having that conversation 2 years ago, Michelle, Rod, your family was going through hell because it happened just a couple of weeks, I think, after Rowan had passed away at the age of just 14 from a very rare form of cancer called Ewing's sarcoma. And it is Rowan's memory which has really helped accelerate Michelle's dream. So I'd like us to chat a little bit about the role he and your family play in this story. Tell us what Rowan was like.
Yeah, Pippa, thank you. Thank you for having us. Rowan was an incredible kid. I'm very biased, but he was a kid who had everything going for himself. He was a clever boy. He excelled at sport. He had lots of friends, and he lived a typical life. And, you know, the last thing you expect is to receive the news that your son has cancer. Mm. So it's been a difficult time. It was a difficult time going through the treatment and trying to live a normal life. But, you know, it's something you never expect. And, you know, it was basically our worst nightmare coming to reality, you know, receiving the news that Rowan was ill and that he had cancer. And unfortunately, he passed away at the age of 14. And, yeah, now it's about keeping his legacy alive. And I've been very fortunate enough to meet Michelle. And, yeah, hopefully there's some wonderful things ahead in his memory.
Yours was not a quick journey. It was a difficult one. Rowan was diagnosed in 2014 with what you thought was just a sports-related injury. It turned out to be cancer when it was finally diagnosed. And I know he went through an initial process of intensive chemotherapy and surgery to remove the tumor and radiation. Obviously, with we know the side effects of those treatments are grueling, to say the least. You had a moment there where you thought you'd made it through that journey, didn't you?
Yes, listen, after the first session of chemo and after the operation, we were told that Rowan was in remission. Everything had gone, but he needed a bit of radiation. Unfortunately, when Rowan was diagnosed, we only found out that he was born with one kidney. And the challenge for the doctors was that where the radiation had to take place was in the area where his only kidney was sitting.
Gosh.
So we had to go through a whole process of trying to figure out what we're going to, you know, how we were going to, you know, go through with the radiation. And eventually the doctors decided that we'd have to basically relocate his kidney. And he had to go through an 8-hour long operation, which they call an auto transplant. And they relocated his kidney into his pelvis. And I think the delay in having, well, basically, the chemo was delayed for the radiation. Sorry, the radiation was delayed for 6 weeks because he had to recover from the process. Yeah. So, he had to go through that as well. And, he continued with the chemo. And, unfortunately, the cancer did come back and he did relapse.
Mm. I mean, to say that your family went through hell is, it doesn't begin to even touch on what you must have gone. You've got two other children.
Correct.
It was not just yourself and your wife grappling with this. It was his siblings, also his friends. I know friends from junior school and his new high school, incredibly touched by his story. Reading your description and the background to Rowan's story, you speak about his courage. You speak about the dignity with which he tried to handle this process, despite being in terrible pain a lot of the time. But you also speak, Rod, about how alone you felt, particularly at the end, where you were facing nights in hospital, as Michelle described, a hospital that's not set up to accommodate families. You were sleeping in the wait in the reception areas. Not all of the staff were fully trained in palliative care. And can you talk to us a little bit about how you felt emotionally from that point of looking for support that just wasn't there?
Yes, Papa. Especially in Rowan's last few weeks, we were in hospital, and Rowan was having some treatment, and unfortunately the facilities aren't there. We were sleeping out on the couches and in the waiting rooms, and it was just very difficult, very emotionally. And you know, that's when I started to question, you know, isn't there a facility where that can accommodate children? Because it just wasn't right. It didn't seem right to me. And unfortunately, you're 100% correct. You do feel alone, but you know, that's basically where myself and Michelle eventually got together, and we started discussing, you know, something that she had been wanting to do for many years, and so here we are.
Yeah,
a very exciting time.
How did you actually connect with Michelle? Did somebody say to you, "Have you heard of Pete's Pal? They might be able to help," or did you find her in the hospital? How did it happen?
No, what happens is, when we were given the news that, and I quote, Rowan could not be saved, we were referred to Michelle. Okay. Basically, Michelle was there to basically administer the meds to control the pain in the final stages.
And okay, so that brings us to 2016. You lost Rowan on the 15th of April, 2016. Michelle, as I mentioned, I think we spoke on right about the 22nd or the 24th of that same year. You were in the infancy of getting Pete's Pal up and running. And you said in that interview that long term, the goal would be that you could take those services in-house and have an inpatient facility where friends could visit, siblings could stay and play and be together, parents could stay and not have to leave their child alone in hospital, and just have that space to hold the whole family. I didn't imagine during that conversation that we would be having this conversation as soon as 2 years later, but the two of you came together. Rod, your own experience and your wish to do something to honor Rowan's memory prompted you to say, well, what can we do? Let's try and fix this problem for other families who will be in this position later. So what did you decide to do?
Well, about 3 weeks after Rowan passed away, a few friends and I, we got together, and we actually formed the Rowan Bloom Foundation. And, you know, we were looking for something tangible. You know, everybody can raise money to fight cancer, but we all know at the moment it's a losing battle. You know, they're making strides, but there isn't a cure for many of the cancers. And you know, having spoken to Michelle and, you know, discussing, you know, basically what she was trying to do, we just started chatting one day, and it just came up that it was a no-brainer. That's what I decided to basically do, is assist Michelle in trying to get this facility open. It was about Rowan's legacy. Mm. And you know what? I made a promise to myself that Rowan's death, he was not going to be another statistic, another cancer statistic. I just wasn't going to let it happen. And so here we are.
Which is where, Michelle, tell us what has happened. Because, as I mentioned, next week you're having a symbolic launch of this facility. You have found a premises and you're ready to go. Tell us what's happened.
So just to kind of backtrack a little bit, we've been looking for a house in which to open this facility for many years. We tried public buildings. We were kind of lobbying the government, all sorts of things. And it was just a very long bureaucratic journey. And every time you visit a patient in hospital and you think and you can see that this could be better, you think, oh, I wish we could just have this house. I wish we could just have this house. About five houses that I went through and eventually decided, no, we just have to find something. So I went onto the Property 4 website, and literally the first property that I clicked on was absolutely ideal for this venture. It was being used as a UCT accommodation. So it was an unusual house in that it had seven bedrooms and five bathrooms, and it was 1.5 kilometers from Red Cross. You couldn't get any more
better location. Yeah.
And the interesting thing, as you know, when you're looking for property, you have to make an offer quickly. Otherwise, somebody else is going to take it up. And so I phoned Rod and said, Rod, I found the house. But we don't actually have the money. So could we
actually put,
yeah, you know, it's not really, you shouldn't really be putting offers if you don't actually have the collateral. And the two of us together with the Pete's Pal, well, both of our boards decided we're actually going to take a leap of faith. And we're just going to put in an offer and hope that the funds are going to come.
It was subject to.
It was subject to.
so we could get out. We needed to. We had to.
Yeah. Okay, but obviously the offer was accepted and the property is now yours. So tell us what, I mean, I know it's a lengthy process still to convert that into a suitable facility. Can you just describe for us what it's going to look like and how it's going to be structured?
So the idea of a hospice is that we need to have the right medical facilities, the right equipment, the right environment on the one hand, so that families actually feel secure, that you've got everything that you need. But on the other hand, we actually want to make a facility that is very homely, where people feel comfortable. So that's quite a difficult marriage, you know, clinical but not. So, and also we want to have enough facilities for siblings and family.
Yep.
So a lot of the planning has been around how do we actually make it comfortable so that families aren't sleeping in waiting rooms on chairs, that actually they can go and sleep in a bed, in a bedroom, and have a good night's rest. Also, how do we bring siblings into that environment? I mean, Rod had the experience where Rowan's siblings had to look at him through the window at Red Cross sometimes because we do restrict visiting to under 12. So make exceptions, but you can't make exceptions all of the time.
Yeah.
So we've actually got spaces in the house where siblings can actually get together, they can play, the families are around. We've also got lounges, we've got little kitchenettes where people can gather, and we've also got therapy rooms where they can actually go for a session, all under one roof. And the house also has a garden, because one of the things, as you can appreciate when you're in hospital, is you kind of got cabin fever. You're in an enclosed space all the time. We do try and take patients out at Red Cross, but it's not easy, you know.
Yeah.
So we really want to enable patients to live as fully as possible for as long as possible, which includes going to a dining room table and eating a meal together, not sitting in your hospital bed with a tray, and going outside and enjoying the sunshine, interacting with other kids, playing where you can. Not being confined to a bed and a particular spot.
The most miraculous thing I think about this vision of yours, Michelle, is that it should be accessible to everyone. This is not going to be an expensive private facility that only the very privileged are able to access. That has always been your ethos from the time I first spoke to you. How do you make that possible?
So we're a public-private partnership, and as an NGO, we will not turn any patients away. We do have some private paying patients, but actually the bulk of our patients are our public sector. So that actually brings us to the next thing. The house is actually the easy part of it. Everybody wants to raise money and put their name in lights, and we bought this bed or we sponsored this room. But actually the difficult part is sustaining the services, the nurses, the doctors, the medicine, the food, the equipment. That is the difficult sell. And it's not just a once-off, it's an ongoing, continuous thing. And we're wanting to provide 24/7 expert care by highly trained professionals, and that costs money.
It does.
Yeah.
Okay, so in a moment we're going to tell our listeners how they contribute if they'd like to, but first I'd like to ask you to both pop your headphones on so that you can hear our caller Debbie, who is on the line, I think wanting to offer her support and if not her time to this venture. Debbie, good afternoon.
Hello. I'm was driving and I had to pull over because I also lost a child in 2012.
I'm so sorry,
and
Debbie.
That I wanted to work for the NSRI afterwards, but I can't go. I tried going to the, you know, to help near the sea, but it used to just send me going mad. And I'm asking in any way if I can help in my time, if there's anything I can do to help with time, or if they need, if you need, sorry, I'm so nervous speaking, but if they need anything in, if we can make money or anything they need me for, can they contact me? And I would love to help.
It's a lovely offer, Debbie. And my producer is taking down your details. I'm sure there are many Debbies out there who are listening to this thinking, I would love to be part of this and love to make a contribution, but maybe don't know what form that contribution can take. And it's not always a financial one that's viable for everyone. Can someone like Debbie be part of the story, Michelle?
So Pete's Panel already has quite a lot of volunteers. Some people want to be on the front line and they want to be involved in children and families. And for some people, that's too scary. And we also have kind of more backstage jobs where they can help with boring things like filing and that kind of stuff. But we currently have volunteers that come to our clinic. They engage with families in the waiting room. They make them tea. Another really difficult project that we are working on is called NODA. So NODA stands for No One Dies Alone. And sadly, what sometimes happens in public hospitals, especially with impoverished families, is people can't always visit their children in hospital. Mm. They come from far, they've exhausted their funds. And we have, unfortunately, had children that have had to die alone with no family around. So we are busy trying to train up a group of strong people who can actually just be with their child. Sometimes also be with a mom who's really struggling to be there and just support them through that difficult process.
It's unthinkable to think of a child in that position. So it would take a very special kind of person. Yeah. There's a lovely SMS here from Sally. Sorry, forgive me. I'm a parent, so this touches very close to the heart, as it does for many, I think. Message from Sally saying, Michelle and her team helped us through our daughter's journey 2 years ago. They were and are absolutely incredible. I'm so happy their dream has been realized and that they will continue their wonderful work. I'm sure there are many other Sallys out there too, Michelle. Rod, I mean, for your family to be able to be part of this and to see... Next week, you've chosen next week for the launch. It is a particularly significant date because the launch on next Thursday would have been Rowan's birthday.
That's correct, Pippa. Next Thursday, the 24th of May, would have been Rowan's 17th birthday. And, we're very proud of what we've done. And, we're very proud about this launch. It's hopefully we can create lots of awareness. Mm. And I must say, people have been very supportive up to now. People have just shown that they care and... that's why I believe the facility will be open, and we will find the funds that we're looking for, and just hopefully we can open it early in 2019.
Can't wait for the follow-up interview when that happens. Michelle and Rod, thank you so much for being with us today. I'd like to just leave our listeners with some contact info if you'd like to be part of this story. The Rowan Bloom Foundation has a website, which is www.rohanbloomfoundation.org. Rohan spelt like the Riders of Rohan for the Lord of the Rings fans, R-O-H-A-N. Peds Pal itself has a website, P-A-E-D-S-P-A-L, pedspal.org.za. If you're driving and can't take down those details, just drop me an email and I'll happily pass them along after the show. Our very best wishes for the launch next week, and look forward to chatting to you when we are at the point of opening the facility's doors. Let's hope it is early 2019. Michelle and Rod, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Pippa, very much.